of Chicago political science professor Charles Lipson, Black Ensemble Theater founder Jackie Taylor, and live music from Irish pianist Cormac McCarthy. And now, here's your host, a man who is thinking about a neck tattoo, Justin Kaufman.
I should get a neck tattoo, but it would be like a little heart. You know, it'd just be a little heart. It wouldn't be anything big. Just a little something to say I love you. Welcome to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight on 720 WGN. I'm very excited. What a great, great night here on Michigan Avenue. A lot of people out on the street, as always. It's always great to be your companion on Friday nights, whether or not you're done with work, you're getting out of town, you're celebrating something, the end of a week. Maybe just walking down Michigan Avenue, maybe starting your job, whatever it is. I'm very grateful to be your companion tonight here on WGN. We got a great show coming up. Professor Charles Lipson is going to join us from the University of Chicago to talk about Brexit. As an American, and I feel, you know, somewhat well-read, and I was reading up about the story. There's a lot more. Every time I read the story, and Pete and I were talking about this, every time I read the stories and the things coming out and I see the follow-ups, I'm still scratching my head like I'm missing something. I don't understand. And Charles Lipson has covered, he was a visiting scholar at the London School of Economics, and he's at the University of Chicago. So I invited him in tonight to help us understand the history of Europe, a united Europe, the EU, 43, 44 years of being in a union that unified those countries and what that means to be broken. We'll talk with Professor Lipson coming up here after the 7:30 news. My guest tonight at the big table, Jackie Taylor. Oh, man, I've been wanting to have Jackie on for a long time. She's the founder of the Black Ensemble Theater in Uptown. They had a brand new space in 2011 that grabbed a ton of headlines. Really great state-of-the-art space right there on Clark Street. We're going to talk to her about 40 years. It's their 40th anniversary. So we'll talk to her about her humble beginnings in the theater at Division and Wells. She was in the movie Cooley High, I don't know if you know this. We'll talk to her about starting Black Ensemble Theater, what it has provided to the Chicago community for the last four decades, and what the future holds for that venerable institution on the north side, the Black Ensemble Theater. That's coming up at 8 o'clock. 9 o'clock, Chewing will be here. Louisa Chu and Monica Ang will talk about the big food news. GMOs got a big vote this week. I believe by the end of this week, there's some serious news when it comes to genetically modified organisms, right? Is that GMOs? Or genetically modified? I don't know what the O stands for. Well, someone will tell me. They'll tell me in an offensive way in the text in about 2 minutes. You can't believe you don't know what it stands for.
You're right.
I was organisms?
Yep.
Oh, never mind. I take that back. That texter's going to be like, right on, Justin. We'll talk about dress codes in Chicago restaurants and bars. We saw that story about the pizza parlor over on the West. I guess it's not a parlor. It's called Parlor. The restaurant in the West Loop that wouldn't let somebody in because they had what they said was unacceptable attire, even though they were like $250 pants. And we'll also... we'll also talk about some other things, including play the game, What Would You Eat? It's coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. And then the 10 o'clock hour, programming notes. The frying pan is not on tonight. Womp, womp, womp. Yep, I know. Steve Gadlin is off. He's out of town, so we took the night off. Instead, we're replacing him with some live Irish music. Cormac McCarthy will be in studio with us. He's playing at Martyrs on Monday. He's being presented by the Irish School of Music here in Chicago. So we'll have live music in our studio at 10 o'clock instead of the frying pan tonight. I know, but we have a good replacement. All that plus news, weather, and traffic with Rob Martyr. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this here is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. Let's take a break, come back, do the carryout. Stay with us. Why don't we start with the carryout? This, of course, our nightly segment where I read the newspaper, so you at home, you don't have to.
Welcome
Here are today's top stories. Well, George Lucas is leaving.
Oh, we don't have a Star Wars clip? Can I just do it myself?
Okay. The Force is with you. I got a bad feeling about this.
George Lucas and his Lucas Museum of Leftover Props are going to California. He and the mayor both took the opportunity to take parting swipes at the Friends of the Park, really so they can vilify them for the next fight. In the end, an outsider billionaire like the lakefront got married there, said, hey, I want to buy this, which is against the rules. A very small and very non-elite non-for-profit is the only group left that is paying attention to rich guys and rich politician land grabs and challenged the lakefront construction in court, which is where it's still at. But Lucas, he wanted to move now, break ground, be damned the rules. I made American Graffiti. See, he and the mayor didn't want to wait for the possibility that a court may agree with Friends of the Park, because then that would set precedent. And then the other rich people would not be able to build their vanity projects on the lakefront, and on and on and on. See, George Lucas is not of the people. He wants to take the people's land and build something with his name on it. Not unlike, I don't know, Ford or Rockefeller or Vanderbilt or the Koch brothers. If he wanted to give back to the city, he could have chose anywhere else but our front yard. How about Inglewood? How about Michigan Avenue? If he were adamant about the lakefront, he could have waited for the courts. But he didn't, which to me is interesting. So the man wants his toy. He wants us to end up paying for it. Don't buy the $700 million investment garbage, because you know we'd be paying through admission fees and maintenance and hidden costs like, oh, wow, it takes $300 million to wax C-3PO. Because if it wasn't the Friends of the Park, it would have been someone else who challenged why we were crowding the lakefront with a personal vanity project. So enough. Look at who has to gain here. Lucas gains. Emmanuel gains. Chicago, you and me, we do not. We get to see how movies are made? Like, look at Stormtrooper suits or art collected by Lucas himself? Yeah, that's what's missing in the city. So I, for one, would like to thank Friends of the Park for their service, and good luck when Mayor Emanuel jumps quick to shove another vanity project down our throats because he feels like he's got some political upper hand. Just watch. And remember, this could have been put somewhere else. So before you let politicians and billionaires point fingers, ask yourself, the lakefront, why? Hey, Han, let's sword fight. I'm not doing it justice. Read the Pulitzer Prize winner Blair Kamen's column today in the Tribune. He breaks it down. What else? The stock market's super down, and Donald Trump put another foot in his mouth about Scotland. So this is what a presidential candidate does. When there's a big news story, he comes out on social media with rash, inaccurate statements that are quickly disputed or discredited by the world. It's shocking how many mistakes Donald Trump is making. Shocking. And if that's not enough, well, Bernie Sanders today said he's not endorsing Hillary Clinton for now. Okay, Bernie needs just something to hold on to, even when it's slipped away. He's like the angry man at the CC's pizza buffet, just standing there staring till more pepperoni comes out. But guess what? No more pepperoni's coming out. It's too close to close. In weather, beauty, but like a Chris Sale fastball, here comes the heat. 90s this weekend. In sports, Derrick Rose was introduced to the New York media, where he said he didn't know why he was traded, but he wanted to thank the Bulls for doing so. Chuckle, chuckle, chuckle. Yeah, you had it so bad, dude. But he did write a love letter today, and he said that he was motivated to make the playoffs and beat the Bulls. So that's going to be gut-wrenching to watch. The Cubs, wow, 4 in a row. They've lost 4 in a row. So I think it's time to bring back the Download Sports talk show host. Matt, told you! I told you it's Joe Maddon and Theo and Ricketts and all these young players. We need a team. Something's got to give. It's ridiculous. All right, we're giving away a six-pack of Pepsi for anyone who could spell Alfonseca. And that was the Download Sports talk show host. The Sox get the Blue Jays at the Cell tonight. You know, it really doesn't stop. Tough schedule. Jose Abreu's out, resting his leg after he got pegged the other night, although I would say it wasn't his leg. Like a fastball to the groin. Yikes. And finally tonight, the Green Bay Packers' Clay Matthews and Julius Peppers will be interviewed by authorities after reports linked them to performance-enhancing drugs. Wait a second. That's not drugs. It's just really good cheese. There's a difference. Or is there? That's the carry out for June 24th, 2016. Hey, enjoy the weekend. Carry out. Coming up, we're going to talk Brexit, what's going to happen with the European Union, and what we just don't understand about this story. Professor Charles Lipson will be with us coming up right here after the news on The Download on 720 WGN. Stay with us. How are you, Rob?
Rob and I kind
of got at each other at the beginning of the show.
I am pleased to announce on a happy note at Shea Martyr in the Northwest Suburbs, I have a brand new 12x10 shed.
You did it!
It's in.
So today?
Yesterday.
That's great, man. Congratulations.
I'm so excited.
All right. So when's the first party in the shed?
I'm telling you what. I'm going to keep the crap in the garage and make this my man cave now.
I love it, man. All right.
It's nice.
All right. We're going to have to ask about it. I'll ask about it later
we'll
in the show.
Later.
We'll get something going here. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Yesterday night, the UK voted to exit the European Union. This news was met with volatile markets today and a concern for the future of Europe and the world. But how did we get here? As a Chicagoan who doesn't pay much attention to European politics and the history of said politics, I'll be honest about that. Is this something that experts have seen coming? Is this something that can be explained through reading the tea leaves and understanding the history of that area? And what's at stake? Beyond our 401ks and what happens to us here in Chicago, what is at stake with Britain leaving the EU? I know a guy who can help. Professor Charles Lipson teaches international politics at the University of Chicago. He's a regular here on WGN. Professor Lipson, good to see you.
Hello, hello, hello.
So let's start. I mean, basically, when I think about it, I think that I always known one thing, and that's that Britain didn't really want to be in the EU.
Right. Well, the EU was formed in the mid-1950s, and the real problem was how could we reintegrate Germany, which had fought a lot of wars against the rest of Europe? How could we reintegrate Germany into Europe? And when the EU was formed in the mid-50s, Britain decided not to join. And then when they decided they wanted to join, President Charles de Gaulle of France wouldn't let them in. Eventually, they did come in, and as they came in, they were a bit reluctant. I think what they like about the EU is they like the free trade. They think of it as a trading bloc. Mm-hmm. What's happened over time is that the EU has done two things. One is it's added more members. I think that's not a problem for Britain. The other is that it's become more and more bureaucratic. Just think of an EU run by a billion Lois Lerners. And there are things, I mean, it's so easy to find bizarre elements, but you can go to England and just like in America, you used to be able to buy a dozen eggs.
Sure.
You can't buy a dozen eggs in England. Why? Because they've decided you can only buy eggs by the kilo. So you have to buy them by weight now. There was literally a proposal to tell you how much a pickle could bend. If it bent too much, it was not a saleable pickle. And I think what, so when we get beyond the ridiculous, anybody
upset,
who's dealt with an American bureaucracy understands it. But the problem was these bureaucrats in Brussels were kind of unanswerable. And the way that elite professionals spoke about it, they talked about it as a democratic deficit. And the fact is, what was happening was that sovereignty was ebbing away. And I think, just as in America, you're beginning to see the problems. And there was an immigration problem.
Right, we're going to get to immigration. But was that the goal of the EU when it was formed, to sort of make Europe one big sort of country, the idea that there'd be one sort of currency, that there'd be one measurement, was that the idea when it was first founded?
No, that was not the idea when it was first founded, but as it evolved, they moved to a concept, and here's the quote, toward an ever closer union. And I think that there are some problems. They've kind of tried to jump halfway across that gully. And you can see one of the problems which came up over the last few years with Greece is that they developed a common currency, but not every country was in it. Britain made the decision not to get into the common currency, and that turned out to be a good decision. They kept the pound. But I think the question now, one of the questions is, if you divorce from the EU, what does that look like?
Right.
Because nobody's ever really done that. But I think some of the complaints are important complaints, and you kind of hear an echo of them in America. I don't mean to say that it's the same, but there's a kind of populist uprising against elites. There's a deep concern about inequality. You see that in Europe as well. There's a concern that the bureaucrats, not elected officials, are running things, and that the elected officials themselves are out of touch with ordinary voters.
Absolutely. And it's interesting, too, because that, I mean, it automatically, or in a way, it creates an enemy or someone to sort of be that. And the EU became that for a lot of populace in England to say, this is the problem. This is why we're having these problems, whether it be immigration, whether it be just ease of life. It's because of this thing. Well, let's get out of it.
Let's make a distinction as you begin to open up markets to globalization. One thing is you, the United States, can sort of lower your tariff barriers and some of your rules that don't allow, let's say, steel or cars come in from Japan or whatever. The next thing you can do is you can begin to cooperate with Canada and Mexico, and you can open up some of your internal borders, but Canada has its own external tariffs and rules about the outside world. The next stage, which is what Europe had gone to 20, 30 years ago, is you set one large border around the whole group for tariffs and so forth. But that doesn't mean if you're from Mexico or Canada, you can immediately move to Chicago. What the EU then did is it moved beyond that to say, if you lived in Poland, you could move just without any permission. Just like in America, you can move from Mississippi, as I did, to Chicago.
Right.
You can move from Poland to England. The problem is that system, which allows people to move around, is as porous as the weakest border. So as soon as somebody comes in from North Africa, the problem wasn't Polish plumbers in London. The problem was as soon as somebody came in from Syria into the Balkans, or they got they came from North Africa and got into Italy, the next thing you knew,
they could go anywhere they wanted
to be.
Well, we saw that to be a problem what happened in as sort of like charting the terrorism that happened in Paris, that they weren't Parisian, they weren't French, they were from somewhere else. But it's easy to move because you're right. They've essentially become one country.
That's exactly right. And what you have beyond terrorism is something that we haven't seen in the United States. In the United States, when people come, at least by the second generation, they're learning English, they're beginning to fit in. We do have some groups, the Somalis in Minneapolis area, where the second generation is not fitting in. But what looks to be the case in Europe is that the groups are large enough.
Muslims from Africa
are now 10% of the French population. You're getting local groups that are fearful. Gays, for example. Women who wear an open-cut jacket. They're really at risk. And people are saying, wait a minute, how is this something that I voted for as being part of the EU?
We're talking about, obviously, Brexit, what happened yesterday with the UK voting to exit the European Union, with Charles Lipson. He is he's a professor of politics, international politics at the University of Chicago, regular here on WGN. We'll take a break. We'll come back and see what's next. Are we going to see just the end of the EU as we know it? And what does that mean for European politics? Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. We're talking about the UK exit from the European Union. I don't know why. I don't want to say Brexit. I feel like that's I don't know. There's something about it that I'm really stumbling on when that word comes up.
With weeks of therapy, yeah. You can get over it.
Charles Lipson's in studio. He's a professor of international politics. He teaches it at the University of Chicago. He's a regular here on WGN. Let's talk about what this means for the EU without the UK. Does this mean that France and Germany, we're seeing it already with Scotland, sort of go the same route and say, yeah, we don't want to be part of the EU as well?
I think that one of the things, and you're seeing it in the market, is introduce a huge amount of uncertainty. I think the key to the EU has always been the French-German partnership. And I think that what you'll see is those two getting together. Item two, I think you'll see them punish the Brits. And that won't just be kind of revenge. If there's no penalty for moving out, then everybody takes the exit train. The third thing you'll see is a rethinking. They'll be blaming Britain. This is the voters are morons, blah, blah, blah. That's what elites always do. But you'll begin to see people thinking, does this mean we should have a kind of EU-lite membership tier where you can join, where you can join, be part of the trade thing, but
you can be at a leadership level, or you can be in the middle level, you can be an entry level.
Exactly. Like I donate to all those things. By the way, you may have seen around town some of the multi-million-dollar gifts, and some of them are called anonymous. I don't want to say that's me. But I do like to make.
You don't
gifts.
Like to brag,
yeah,
right,
yeah,
right,
exactly.
Right. But I mean, you know, I was just thinking, we were talking with Pete about this again. I kind of come from this from a layman's standpoint. I don't know a lot about European political history, but the one thing I do know is that France and Britain, they've kind of been at each other for centuries. Is this sort of the beginning of another chapter of that kind of history?
But so have France and Germany. I think that if you wanted to think, how could something really bad come out of this? You would say that it could be a meltdown of some of the post-World War II arrangements. We still live in a post-World War II arrangement. And the great genius of what happened is that with a U.S. pacifier, the Brits, the French, and the Germans, groups that have always been at each other's throats, have formed a peaceful relationship. I don't think that will change. But I think, and in particular, I think that what the Germans decided is they answered the question, how can we get rich without getting scary? And their answer to that was, we can get rich without being scary if we stick to Europe like Velcro, rather than developing an autonomous polity where we have our own military, which will inevitably scare both the Russians and the French and the British, and then you see a coalition against them. I think the Germans don't want that to happen. It won't happen, but they have to figure out a way to bring the EU together. Now, a key part of this was that the U.S. played a pacifying role. And what you see now is a lot of voices in the U.S. saying, hey, let's pull back ourselves.
So I'm fascinated by this because I'm interested in what Russia it thinks of all this, because they're just kind of, I haven't heard much about Russia responding to this. They're just on the, and they've always sort of had this adversarial relationship with the EU or with you know, just the Western countries. Do they see this as an advantage that Britain has left the EU?
The Russians see this as a total advantage.
The Russians want to send a wedge into the EU. They were not just scared about NATO moving into Ukraine. Yeah. They were scared about the Ukraine joining the EU. That was actually what pushed them over the edge. So they were perfectly happy to see floods of Syrian refugees moving in and that tearing apart the EU. They're happy to see the EU at each other's throats. Remember, the EU is actually closely related to NATO because all the key members are part of NATO. So this is all to the good for Vladimir Putin.
All right, so let's ask the golden question, which is how does this affect the United States politically when we think about an election year with Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump? You know, Barack Obama was really pushing, you know, putting passion behind the idea of staying with the EU. It didn't happen. There's been a lot made that the voters resemble the same kind of voters that would vote for Donald Trump. What's the takeaway you in the U.S. politically?
I think there are two arrows and they're pointing in different directions. The arrow pointing toward we don't want as much globalism, we want more national control, we want to pull back from some of these international commitments. That's what happened in the Brexit vote. That's exactly the themes in Trump's campaign. The immigration issues also look similar, even though there are substantial differences. Pushing in the other direction, and that's what everybody's emphasized today. They haven't emphasized a counter arrow that's worth thinking about. The more uncertain things are, the more people look to a kind of familiar leader. And that's what Hillary will say. She'll say, boy, there's a lot of uncertainty. Boy, you look, as soon as Donald Trump lands in Scotland, he puts his foot in his mouth, that sort of thing. Do you want to pile more uncertainty on? My hunch is that the nationalist dimension will be more important. If, however, Britain goes into a serious recession right away, which is a possibility, and begins to pay a price for this right away, then she will add to that claim, see, you might like giving a giant finger to the political establishment, but just know you're going to pay a huge price, and I can save you from that, me, Hillary.
Well, it's interesting. We'll see how it plays out. I'm sure we'll talk with Chris and Dave on Touche about that on Monday. Professor Charles Lipson, he teaches international politics at the University of Chicago. He's a regular here on WGN. Thanks so much for coming in and talking about this. We appreciate
it. Absolutely. My pleasure.
All right. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNradio.com. I enjoyed that conversation immensely. You know, I feel bad, but I'm like, there are some things that I'm not perfect, and there are a lot of things that I just like people listening at home, I'm like, I just don't understand. I need to get past the headlines. I need to understand this more. And I had my eyes glazed over a lot in the international European politics discussion that's been happening the last couple of days. And to have him in there and to actually go a little deeper to say it's not, you know, what the last thing he said about automatically people are like, oh, you know, they spoke for Trump. You're like, this actually could have an adverse effect for the Republican candidate. And more so, understanding the relationships between France and Germany and Britain, and what this means, and what's going to happen when they're going to definitely try to punish Britain for leaving. This is going to be interesting. We should have Professor Lipson on more. Anyway, I learned something. See, it learns. See, it's learning.
I can see it pulsating down there.
It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 9 o'clock, Louisa Chu and Monica Eng are going to be here with podcast Chewing. Did I say that in order? Louisa Chu, yeah, Monica Eng got it, Chewing. The podcast, they'll both in. We'll talk about some issues about GMOs, also about dress codes in Chicago restaurants, and also play the game, What Would You Eat? It's a fun little game we play. And also coming up at 10 o'clock, we will have live Irish music. That's right. No frying pan tonight. Live Irish music. Cormac McCarthy, who's playing at the Martyrs. He's playing at Martyrs coming up on Monday. So we'll have the band in here in the 10 o'clock hour. The Black Ensemble Theater is celebrating its 40th anniversary here in Chicago. The theater's presented some amazing award-winning work over those four decades, including the Jackie Wilson story, Doo-Wop, Shoo-Bop, and the Marvin Gaye story, Don't Talk About My Father Because God Is My Friend, which has been remounted this summer at the theater in Uptown, and it runs to July 10th. The founder of the theater company is Jackie Taylor. Taylor started as an actress in movies like Cooley High, but opened up Black Ensemble Theater on 1429 North Wells Street in 1976 to produce plays that had positive roles for African Americans. Taylor moved to the theater, moved the theater to Uptown, and since 2011 to a brand new space that they built in the 4400 block of Clark Street. Jackie Taylor grew up here in Chicago. She's been in theater for 40 years here, and she's my guest tonight at the big table. Jackie Taylor, great to see you.
It's wonderful to be here. Yay!
Let's first talk. I mean, this is a great year for you because it's almost like a greatest hits year for you to celebrate the 40th anniversary. And right. Let's talk about the Marvin Gaye show. You guys have done such great work with musical. They're not necessarily musicals, but they're musical celebrations.
Right, absolutely. And you know, we pick icons because who doesn't love an icon? Who doesn't want to know all those dirty little secrets as you're listening to the music? And we use music because music is transformational. You know, the mission of the Black Ensemble Theater is to eradicate racism. And we decided, hey, let's do this in a way, let's not recreate the wheel. What already crosses cultural boundaries? And the answer, of course, is music. So a lot of our shows are based on music.
For your 40th anniversary season, what was the criteria to bring the shows back? Was it the best? I mean, you said it's the greatest hits, but what were the greatest hits for Black Ensemble Theater? 40 years of shows.
40 years. I can't believe it. It was just like yesterday. I was only two when it all started. You know, it's really based off of what is very most popular. And then, I mean, to be realistic and down to earth, you know, what makes the most money? Because
yeah, it's theater.
You got to stay alive. So it's economics.
Let's talk about the Marvin Gaye show. What made you come up with a show about Marvin Gaye and his life?
You know, in actuality, I didn't come up with the show. His sisters came to me. And they asked me to produce a play about their brother. And I, of course, you know, I was very excited. But the kind of play that they wanted me to produce was totally out of my character. They wanted me to highlight the murder. They wanted me to talk about, to highlight all the negative aspects and to make it very...
A lot of the controversy that surrounds Marvin Gaye.
And right? I just couldn't do it. So I decided
Why couldn't you do it? I
couldn't write that. If you want to see that, turn on the TV or look at the newspaper, you'll get it every day. That's not my style. I want to uplift you. I want to show you how joyful and positive life can be. And it's enough degradation in the world. Mm-hmm. I don't need to add to it, and I will not add to it. So I decided, no, I'm not doing that. I am going to write my own Marvin Gaye story, and it's not going to be anything about what you all want me to write it about. And they tried to sue me, but you know, Marvin Gaye is a public figure, so anybody can write.
What was so different about what you were putting on stage? Was just the idea that you weren't telling that story?
They wanted me to tell their story. And I didn't want to tell their story.
There you go. For the music, I mean, obviously it plays a big role. When you're casting a show, when you're putting together a show about Marvin Gaye and his contributions to the music landscape, one of the most iconic musician of all time.
Yes.
What do you look for?
Well, of course, you have to look for someone who looks like and sounds like and talks like Marvin Gaye. Hey, that's the first thing.
Is that easier said than done?
You know what? We developed our actors. And when you're a good actor, you can play anybody. But you got to do the work. You got to put the work in. And Rashawn Thompson, you got to start with a great foundation. And Rashawn Thompson plays Marvin Gaye. And he has a great foundation. He's a great singer. He's a very handsome guy. You have to study, you have to emulate, you have to do your research, and you have to work. You have to work to look like, to talk like, to act like that person, and you have to become that person on stage. And Rashawn is, he's outstanding. You know, if folks didn't know that Marvin wasn't here with us anymore, they would swear... Is that him?
Where do you and the actors go to find that material? Because there's so much now that you can find out about Marvin Gaye, whether it be biographies or stories. But also, I mean, you can see some of the performances live on television.
Right.
Where do you find the material to accurately portray Marvin Gaye.
Well, you know, this is the age of technology. My goodness, internet. You
see,
can
just
come
stand
on.
There pressing play on YouTube come over on. And over. But ain't no mountain high enough on a.
Yeah, come on. he raised his lip right there on that line. So, no, you. I mean, you know, it's the world today. How we get our information is so quick, so fast, and it's so much. So it's out. It's there.
For you, what's special about this show? To bring this show back, to bring it back as 40th anniversary. You know, it's obviously a popular show, and it's going to be, like we said, money. But what is it about this show that you find special?
You know, I think what runs through all my shows, not only this show, but all of my shows, is that they have to be uplifting. They have to cross cultural boundaries. They have to help us realize that as human beings, we are so much more alike than we are different. And they help us to understand and respect that. And it tears down that bridge that is between us and helps us to just be who we are and be comfortable with that. And because of that, especially in today's environment, people need it. They're looking for it and they want it.
Well, the show is called The Marvin Gaye Story, Don't Talk About My Father Because God Is My Friend. It's on stage at the Black Ensemble Theater up at the 4400 block of North Clark Street through July 10th. Jackie Taylor's the founder of Black Ensemble Theater. She's with me tonight. She's my guest at the big table. We'll continue the conversation, talk about 1429 North Wells Street when we return. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. We're jamming out here on the Michigan Avenue, the Allstate's Showcase Studio, with Jackie Taylor. She's the founder of the Black Ensemble Theater Company, which we're going to talk about how it began. It's celebrating its 40th anniversary this year. The show, The Marvin Gaye Story, Don't Talk About My Father Because God Is My Friend, is on stage at the Black Ensemble Theater in Uptown through July 10th. Jackie, we mentioned 1429 North Wells. Before we get to that, let's talk about when did you first get into entertainment, into theater, into being an actress?
Oh, I think I was about 3 years old when I went into the closet and started talking to all these people and made up all these stories. And they thought I was really crazy, but I didn't care. And then I think my first stage appearance was... we did a Tom Thumb wedding when I was in kindergarten, and I really wanted to be the bride because she had a line, and her line was, "I do." And I kept telling the teacher, I want to be the bride. And she said, "No, you're the bridesmaid." And the bridesmaid doesn't have any lines. I just want you to stand there. And I was really upset, you know, because I really wanted a line.
Right.
And so I went out and I stood there like she told me to, and I didn't say anything. But then when the bride said, "I do," I said, "I do too." And it brought the house down. I said, "I was born to be on the stage." And that's how it all began.
That's how it began. That's a great origin story. It's a great beginning to a play, right? Right there. But for you, I mean, growing up in Chicago and Cabrini Green, what was the resources available to you to get into theater, to learn more about the craft? Talk about your schooling and the idea of getting more serious about being an actress.
Well, you know, in Cabrini, like all poverty areas, there were resources. We had a lot of resources. Mr. Houston was a drama teacher at Seward Park. And it was a group of us. We were about 9 or 10. And we were throwing bricks through windows, having a great time, you know, passing the time away, throwing bricks. Ha, ha, ha. And we threw a brick through the park. And Mr. Houston came out and started chasing us. And we all started running, and I was the slowest one. So I got caught. And Mr. Houston said, "Well, you know that you are destroying property." And I said, "Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't mean it." He said, No. He said, "You got two choices." He said, "When you destroy property, you can go to jail." He said, and what you guys, what you all are doing now, you're paving the way to go to jail. He said, or you can come up to my drama class and take drama, or I'll call the police. And I was like, didn't know what drama class was, but
I'll take drama class. Right.
Said, I'm coming to your drama class, Mr. Houston.
And what kind of drama class was? What do you remember about it?
Oh, well, I got to act. In fact, he was doing The Wizard of Oz, and I got to play Dorothy. And I was like, it was the greatest thing in the world. I was like, and he taught me about self-confidence, and he taught me about, and then I went to the schools in my area, St. Joseph's School, where the nuns nourished that creativity, you know, because I was crazy. And I had to have the focus all the time, and they couldn't control their classroom because I controlled it. So they gave me the gym and said, hey, look, you can write, you can act, you can do whatever you want as long as you do your work. And then we'll give you the last hour of school and we'll give you some kids and you can do whatever you want to do. So I wrote shows and put on what we called spirit days. And we had them every week. Every Friday we put on a show.
I mean, it's such a great, again, where this is the, I have dibs on the Jackie Taylor story. Right? I have dibs on that story. All right. So let's flash forward to, you know, in the story and the stuff that I was reading about you, you know, you had a couple of acting opportunities, Cooley High being one of them here in Chicago. Mm-hmm. It was like the mid 70s. And, right. And out of that experience, you realized that you wanted to continue to do it, but there weren't a lot of options at that point. So that's really how the Black Ensemble Theater began.
Well, you know, with Cooley High, I'd got a contract with American International Pictures, and I was able to, work with that company. And I, you know, my goal was to be the first African-American woman to win the Academy Award. I wasn't thinking about a theater company. And in that experience, I really was faced with systematic racism in a way that I had never experienced it before. Now, I experienced it all my life growing up in Chicago. Mm-hmm. But in the way that I experienced it as a professional actress, making movies and the kind of things that they wanted me to say and the kind of things that they wanted me to do. And there was a script about Cabrini, and I lived in Cabrini, and I was like, we don't talk like that. We don't act like that. What the hell are you doing?
Yeah, right.
And I wanted the writers to change it, and they told me to shut up. And this is it's not about telling the truth. It's about making money. And they wanted me to perpetuate the violence. And at that time, I was also a school teacher, and I had taught thousands of kids from Cabrini, and I had taught them nonviolence, self-respect, love your fellow man. And if they had seen me in those roles that they wanted me to play, they wouldn't be able to say, it would have destroyed everything.
Because for you to have been to go into Hollywood at that point, this was blaxploitation.
Right. This was the black exploitation
time,
period.
Right.
So I decided, okay, do I want to perpetuate this nonsense and make this money, or do I want to make a difference? And I decided, no, I got to make a difference. It's not about money. It's about feeling good about who you are and leaving this life feeling like you added some value to it.
Jackie Taylor's my guest tonight. She's the founder of the Black Ensemble Theater, which is celebrating its 40th anniversary. We're talking about the origins of that theater company. Let's take a quick break for the news. We come back, we'll pick up with starting that company, trying to create a theater company that had positive roles for African-Americans, and talk about the theater in Chicago at that time. Jackie Taylor, my guest tonight. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. My guest at the big table, Black Ensemble Theater founder, Jackie Taylor. The show, The Marvin Gaye Story, Don't Talk About My Father Because God Is My Friend, is at the theater in Uptown on the 4400 block of Clark Street through July 10th. It's the 40th anniversary of the Black Ensemble Theater. That's hard to believe.
Yeah, 40
years. You don't look a day over 40.
Well, thank you, dear. I believe you.
Let's talk about the beginnings of the Black Ensemble Theater, 1976, 1429 North Wells. Talk about making that move and starting a company, this company.
Well, that's very interesting because I was actually walking down the street and I said, you know, I'm going to start a company. I'm going to start a theater company, and I want to be able to control the images that come out about African-American people. So I was walking down the street in my neighborhood because I lived right that's right in Cabrini. Mm-hmm. And I said, God, I need a theater. And I looked up and it said Theater for Rent.
Again, the story, the Jackie Taylor story.
And I said, thank you. And I went in and I told the guy that I wanted to start a theater company. It's a black theater company. And I told him the whole story. And he took out a sheet of paper and he started. He said, yeah, I'll rent you the theater. He said, let me see. The lights are $450. The sound is $250. The seats, I'm going to charge you $150 for that. If you want to use the concession stand, you want to use the box office. He said, oh, yep. So about $900 a month,
wow.
I'll rent the theater to you. I said, well, how much are you getting now? And he said, well, it's empty. I said, yeah, I'll give you $200 and you're going to give me everything on that damn sheet. And that was the end of that. I got the theater.
I was going to say, $900. That's great. That's how you do it. For everyone out there who wants to negotiate with a theater owner, if it's empty, there you go.
There you go.
So how long did you stay at 1429?
2 years.
And what kind of plays were you putting on stage at that point?
Well, at that point, I produced, my first play was The Other Cinderella, and because I starred as Cinderella. So it ran for 2 years. So we were there for 2 years. And I had a lot of great people behind me. I had people like Irv Kupsnet and his wife, Essie Kupsnet, mm-hmm. Who, God rest their soul, but they were highly influential in because they believed
they supported
in,
you, yeah.
in the mission. They got their friends to support the theater. So, and Sidney Poitier was one of, Irv's friends, and he called and said he would.
What was that like?
It was crazy because I was like, this ain't no Sidney Poitier. Who is this? He said, yes, Miss Taylor, this is Mr. Poitier, and Mr. Kupsnet asked me to call you and to talk with you. I'd like for you to come down to the set. And you know, him and Bill Cosby were producing all those movies here in Chicago. So I went down to the set and I talked to him about the Black Ensemble Theater. And he was my first celebrity that made a substantial donation to the company. And I was also, and I'm also an actress in theater. And at that time, I was performing all over town in various roles. And Dennis Zajac invited mm-hmm. me to Victory Gardens and said, hey, I want you to perform here and you can also produce your theater company in my little theater. And I was like, that's a good deal. So I worked there. And then Stuart Gordon from the Organic Theater,
yeah, right.
He said, hey, I want you over here. So I got a little theater. So
let me ask you, I mean, you're mentioning some luminaries when it comes to the history of Chicago off-loop theater. Mm-hmm. What was it like? I mean, thinking back to that time, what was it like? How has it changed? I'm just, give us an inside glimpse to the idea of the community that was Chicago theater at that time.
There is no community like Chicago theater in the world. None like it. It was like what it is today. It's very inclusive, very supportive, very interactive and sharing resources, very daring. I've done a lot of theater and I've been a lot of places, and no other theater community in the world, and that includes the NYC, compares to the theater community.
Why did
of Chicago.
You stay here? Why did you stay in Chicago? I mean, as someone who had
it
their
was
sights
so
on Hollywood.
Vibrant. It was just so alive. It was just so much going on, and the community kept me here. I mean, I always had a job. I always had a place for my theater. It was just the best place to be. It was so much to do, and films were coming here, so it was no need to go anywhere. Everybody has this great dream of Broadway, and what we have here is so much better than what they have there.
How, you know, for you making the transition to start your own theater company because of what you saw in terms of racism, systemic racism, when it came to blaxploitation films, and when you got into theater here, what were the opportunities for African Americans? I mean, you started your own company, but not only what were the opportunities for actors and creatives who wanted to be in the theater community, but also the audiences that were coming to see your stuff.
Well, you know, first of all, people have a fallacy that black people don't go to the theater, and that's just crazy. Our community we had the first Shakespearean theater in 1898 here in Chicago. It was African American. So it's, you know, that's a fallacy. But the theater community was quite vibrant. It was all kinds of, at that time, the Goodman was doing what was considered to be a real revolutionary thing, not starring, but putting black people on their stage. You know, they lost 50% of their audience.
Really?
Yes, because they were doing shows like To Be Young, Gifted, and Black by Lorraine Hansberry. And at that time, you know, that was revolutionary.
This would be late 70s, yeah. 80s, early
80s. Late 70s. So it you know, it was people like Rock Schoffer and Greg Mosier and I mentioned Dennis, I mentioned Stewart. But, I mean, these were minds who thought past color. You know, they were interested in great theater. You know, and it wasn't about race. It was about the message and the strength of the piece. And so Dennis produced a lot of African American theater, not because he was thinking, oh, I want to produce black theater so I can get the grants. No. He was producing it because it was great theater.
Well, it's also, I mean, the stories.
That's what
I'm saying. Black Ensemble Theater included. I mean, the stories that you're talking about, Jackie Wilson, Marvin Gaye. But there are a lot of stories that go along with
Absolutely.
Black theater.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, like I said, you know, racism is systematic. We've been taught to think that African Americans are less. And that's just a lie. And that our culture is based off of white culture. It's a lie. We have our own stories. We have our own greatness. We have our own culture that should be accepted and be side by side, and it's emulated in a lot of ways. People don't they somehow do not admit to it, but when it comes to African American culture, when we start something, it's emulated. All of a sudden, it becomes part of the regular, you know, the walk of life. So people just have to understand we got to get out of this mentality of looking at each other through racial eyes, because that's not what it's about.
Jackie Taylor is the founder of the Black Ensemble Theater, celebrating their 40th anniversary right now on stage. The Marvin Gaye story, Don't Talk About My Father Because God Is My Friend. It's being remounted. It's on stage through July 10th in Uptown at the Black Ensemble Theater. Okay, we'll take our last break and we'll continue our conversation here on The Big Table. Stay with us. It's The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest tonight, Black Ensemble Theater founder Jackie Taylor, celebrating 40 years here in Chicago. Amazing feat. A lot of theater companies, they don't make it to 10 years. Make it to 15. If you know, you'll see a 20 and everyone's like, oh my God. 40 years. What does that mean to you to be able to do theater here in Chicago for 40 years?
You know what? I looked at my pension the other day. I was like, hey, this is all right. So, hey. So I mean, you know, it's very rewarding. It really is. And it makes me very proud of my city. It really does. It makes me very proud of my community, because you can definitely make a very wonderful, strong career And not only that, but you can provide jobs for others on a consistent basis that they might not have. So
for all the people that come through, actors, but also technicians, other people, administrators.
Absolutely. You know, with the new Black Ensemble Theater Cultural Center, we tripled our staff to 28 full time, and I don't know how many part time. And it puts a lot of people to work because we have maintenance, we have security, we have cleaning, we have an in-house doctor sometime, you know. So it puts a lot of folks to work and gives and provides opportunities. And to be able to do that for 40 years, and now we're looking at what we're calling our 2020 vision, Free to Be, where we are going to expand into the next 25 years. And we intend to bring to Chicago some exciting ventures that we'll talk about at another time.
You got to come back. What I love about the mission of Black Ensemble Theater, and there's a lot of mission statements, and you see that around Chicago with a lot of theater companies, a lot of big lofty words thrown around, and you're like, I think I know what this means. but for a long time, and it's been a pretty simple sentence, mm-hmm. that the Black Ensemble Theater exists to eradicate racism.
That's it.
How does theater go about doing that?
You know, theater is transformative and it's educational. The more we understand about each other, the better we can accept each other. Theater brings people together. It helps them to accept and substantiate their likeness as human beings. It tears down that wall. So it's a lot of ways that theater and the arts in general can be used to help decrease the inaccuracies that exist in our society. I'm a prime example. I'm from a community of violence, a community of poverty, and what brought me out of that community was the arts. What helped me I love my community, I embrace my community, I'm proud of where I grew up, but what helped me to not embrace the poverty and the violence was that the arts taught me that I could be whatever it was that I wanted to be.
The newer generation, I mean, obviously you do a lot of outreach and a lot of workshops and you take on that issue. But there are a lot of young Chicagoans that are coming up, you know, that are faced with more and more violence, that are faced with poverty. How do you get the arts to them when governments, agencies, grant makers, so many different people are cutting back. The economy goes sour, and those are the first things to go. From you, your vantage point as an educator, as an artist, as someone who has held this job for 40 years, how do you get the arts to somebody in that community?
First of all, we have to embrace the arts that are already there. The arts are there. It's definitely a sculptor, a singer, a dancer, a poet. We have to support what's there. It's, you know, racism is systematic. It's embedded in the culture. And one of the major things that happens is that with ignorance, we start taking away those things that are vital to our existence, like the arts. So people have to realize, governments have to realize, the educators have to realize the arts are a vital part of education. They're not separate from it. They are part of it. And when you take it away, it takes away the ability of many students to learn, because you learn through the arts. You have to focus, you have to listen, you have to concentrate, you have to remember. Those are skills that you need not only to learn, but in the arts. You have to focus, you have to listen, you have to concentrate, and you want to.
Right.
So when that starts happening, you're able to transfer those skills to something else that you need in your life. So when we take away the arts, we're taking away a vital aspect of how we're able to exist as human beings, and we're destroying ourselves.
40 years as the founder and CEO of Black Ensemble Theater. Do you Do you see a day in the short future where you step away from the theater, where you say this was okay, that was a great career, you know, time for something else, maybe time to retire? I mean, what are you thinking about for the next?
Retire? Retire?
I didn't mean to say.
Don't cuss me out, Justin. What are you talking about,
I'm saying,
man?
What's the next step for Jackie Taylor? I mean, 40 years running a theater company.
Well, listen, you know, no one lives forever. Unfortunately, and with the world is the way the world is today, I don't know who would want to live forever. So what I'm doing is creating a foundation that will allow for Black Ensemble Theater to continue outside of Jackie Taylor. So if Jackie Taylor wants to go away with her 30-year-old boyfriend somewhere, okay, he's not really 30, but you know, I can dream, can I? Anyway, if I want to, whatever I want to do, I will be able to do that with the understanding and the foundation that I have built for the Black Ensemble Theater to continue outside of me. I do not have founder's syndrome. I don't want to hold on to this damn thing forever because I'm going to grow old. I'll be about 97, 98, but by that time I'll probably claim, okay, I'm old.
All right. But I
want for it to survive. And the only way that it can survive is to transcend me.
Well, I can't think of a Black Ensemble Theater without Jackie Taylor. And I mean, that's a good thing. Jackie Taylor's the founder of the Black Ensemble Theater here in Chicago, celebrating the 40th anniversary. On stage now, the Marvin Gaye story, Don't Talk About My Father Because God Is My Friend. It's a remount. It's on stage till July 10th at the Black Ensemble Theater on Clark Street. Jackie Taylor, thanks so much for coming in, sharing your story, and being my guest tonight at the Big Table.
It's been my pleasure, Justin, really. I love it. Thank you.
Well, that was fun. Jackie Taylor, how about that? What a great story. I have dibs on the origin story, the Jackie Taylor story. I need a catchy sentence after, though. You know, something like...
From rags to riches.
Right, exactly. Like the Jackie Taylor story from 1429 Wells to beyond. I don't know. I'll figure it out.
From Wells to Bells.
Oh, great. Great stuff, though, man. Like, I love being able to, like, the story about throwing bricks through the park. And Seward Park, that's a park where played softball for a while.
And I like how she said it with just a kind of a little mischievous, you know, that tinge still in her voice. Like, we knew what we were doing wasn't good, but we were having such fun.
And, I mean, it's also, I give a lot to Mr. Houston, the idea that instead of just, you know, wringing their necks... He says, all right, well, I'm going to help you. You take this drama class and get you guys off the street. That's great. You know, you don't hear those stories as much anymore.
We're going to make you be a better human being.
Right.
Yeah.
That's the Park District. That used to be their motto, making you a better human being. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNradio.com. Coming up, Monica Eng and Louisa Chu. They're here, the women behind the podcast Chewing. We're going to talk some food issues. GMOs are back on the table. Also talk about dress codes at some Chicago establishments. Really interesting. You know, I saw the story at Parlor in the West Loop about not letting the guy in because he had fancy sweatpants on. $250 sweatpants. Give me a break. It's too much. Like, I love that my response to that story was not, you know, what's going on there? Are they being racist at the door? I'm like, who pays $250 for sweatpants?
That's steep.
That's steep. Also, lead in the Chicago Public School water. And then we'll also play the game, Would You Eat It? It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. No frying pan tonight. I know. Steve Gadlin is out tonight. He's out of town. He'll be back next Friday. So no local inventions, no local innovations, no local entrepreneur tonight. Instead, we've got live Irish jazz music. So that's a nice transition. That's a, that's, you know, we provide alternatives here on the download. So that's coming up. No frying pan tonight. Instead, live music, live jazz, Irish jazz. All right, sound good? All right, in studio with us tonight, our regular food correspondents, Monica Eng and Louisa Chu. I should say Louisa Chu and Monica Eng because they are the duo Chewing.
That's we are.
That's right.
The podcast Chewing, which you can find at chewing.xyz.
That's correct.
Trendsetters.
Chewing.xyz.
Yes.
There you go. Subscribe today.
But it's a great podcast about all things food, issues, you know, trying new things.
Health.
Food and health, yeah. Sometimes healthy food.
How you guys do? Not often. How are you guys?
We're good,
we're
Justin.
Great. We're great. We taped a couple episodes tonight and came on over to see our favorite WGN DJ. You're a host.
I like DJ. No, I think that actually works. Hey, yeah. All right. Well, thanks for being here, guys. Let's get to the new song from Cheap Trick. All right. GMOs playing a big role this week. There was some movement, as we know, and we've talked about on this program before. GMO labeling is something that is sort of snaking its way through the U.S. government.
Yeah.
Where are we on that?
So the House passed a version of what they call the DARK Act. Some people call the DARK Act. Some people call it the Fair Food Labeling Bill. And then the Senate has been caught up. They cannot agree. And everybody has been, well, many people wanted to get some sort of national law passed before Vermont, on July 1st, started labeling state by state.
So Vermont was going to, and they still are, on July 1st, they'll be the first state that actually labels on a can of
requires tomatoes,
it says, this is a GMO.
This contains genetically modified ingredients.
Exactly. And we just set it up, the companies that produce genetically modified organisms or that kind of
they
food,
don't
they
that.
Don't want that.
Yeah.
Why don't they want that?
Well, that's actually a fantastic question, because if you're proud of your product, of course you want everyone to know that it's in there. And more than 60 countries already require them to be labeled. In the United States, we are one of the few that doesn't. So there's been this long battle, state by state. Should it be national? Should it be state by state? And so finally, as the Vermont deadline started looming, they said, we've got to come up with a national plan. We can't have this patchwork. And it looks like we are going to have the patchwork, at least for now, because even though the Senate committee came to an agreement this week, they haven't had a chance to vote on it. And the House, which would have to agree with it and some sort of harmonious bill together, they're out till July 5th. So this is going to happen in Vermont. Campbell Soup, General Mills, they've already said, look, we're just going to label. We can't do one label for Vermont and another label for the rest of the country. This proposal is saying, let's not have a label, let's have QR codes.
This is the proposal in the Senate.
The proposal in the Senate is different from the House, so they would have to align those bills. But right now they're saying, let's put a QR code on it. Now, I'd like to ask you guys, when's the last time you used a QR code?
That's a good question.
I actually was looking for an app for it because there's a statue outside the building here, and I never know what he's going to say, so you have to scan the QR code.
Yeah, and I never.
That's what the opponents of this bill say. They're like, you know what? That's tantamount to just not having the information on
communication
there.
To the future, Monica.
Right.
QR
code. It seems like it was very promising at one time. So we'll see if they can get 60 votes, but it's going to go ahead in one of our states. And our whole episode last week, I know it sounds really boring, but it's actually a very interesting episode about GMO labeling. We talked to Neil Young. I talked to him at Farm Aid last year.
Well, let's actually set this up, Monica, because you didn't just talk to Neil Young. You and your mom were kind of like GMO groupies. You had to like talk your way into his trailer or something,
I was hosting a panel.
Right.
And so I saw, I was hosting a panel at Farm Aid. And so I saw his manager. I said, hey, you know, I'd love to stop by and just talk to him a bit about GMOs for my podcast.
Is Neil Young a big GMO guy?
What the name of his last album was called? The Monsanto Years. It's pretty much
so
dedicated
he's advocate
to
for that. Yeah.
He's an advocate for labeling.
Yeah, right.
So he had many things to say about campaign finance reform, about which presidential candidates might clean up this
was
country.
Was he cool? Like, was it easy to get, like, him to talk about this stuff, or was he like, I'm done playing guitar, stay away from me?
Well, as I said on the podcast, they said, you want to talk to him for what? I said, it's our podcast. It's called Chewing the Fat. And I had to like put it on my phone and show, hey, see here, you can listen to it on my phone. So the manager took my phone and went into this trailer, tractor trailer, and he came out with no phone. And he said, okay, you're all right.
What
so
a
my
line.
So my mom and I walk into the back of this truck, and there are all these exercise machines and hockey jerseys in there. And they said, okay, you can talk to them. I'm like, is my phone somewhere?
Where's my phone? You don't get that back.
So no, they gave it back to me. And he was very nice. You know, he sounds a little grumpy. I guess, you know, if you've got to tour the
country.
You're
Neil Young, man.
But he talked to me about his thoughts on food and food labeling and what he eats and what he doesn't eat and which presidential candidates might be able to stop what he sees as kowtowing to industry and the need for.
Well, there's, I mean, that industry is an industry that is pretty powerful. Monsanto mm-hmm. and genetically modified foods.
Big Ag has a lot
of
power.
And they have
a lot
of lobby power in Congress, right?
Yeah. And I have to say that as much as I give Monica a hard time, she got a very good, candid interview, very lively interview from Neil Young about that whole topic. He had a lot to say and was very, very forceful about those.
Any live acoustic performances?
I tried to get sort of sing along. It didn't
from
happen.
From Monica, you can also hear in that episode, Monica's actually got a food policy jingle that she plays.
Well, Miranda and I came up with a little food
her
policy
daughter, Miranda.
Jingle. And you could listen to it at chewing.xyz. Mm-hmm. It starts out the episode. We could maybe do a few bars. What do you think?
No, yeah, Miranda's in studio with us.
Food policy time.
Yeah, it's a cappella.
Everybody loves
sing along now.
Food policy time. Dunk, dunk, dunk. That's
going to be one of the most downloaded food policy jingles of all time.
I was thinking that maybe Neil Young would hear it and think maybe backup singer, guitar player.
That's what I was worried. Monica was going to try to palm a cassette. You know,
like that was the real reason to go on a trailer. Listen,
I've got a demo
for a food policy jingle.
We talked to Michael Pollan. We talked to the head of the Farm Bureau because I wanted to get, you know, a more sort of mainstream view. And then the Illinois Farmers Union. So I feel like it's a very informative podcast.
I mean, you've been covering this issue for a long time. When we hear that it's going to be a patchwork of states and Vermont is a much more sort of progressive state when it comes to agriculture and farming, where does the Midwest fit in when it comes to labeling? Does the state of Illinois have any say in one way or the other in what you think they may go?
Well, there have been quite a few attempts to label in Illinois. The last one was from a representative out of Peoria whose name escapes me at this point. He said he wasn't going to bring it to a vote until he really had gathered the kind of consensus he would need to pass it. I believe he's still working on it. It's, you know, this would be a tough state to pass that kind of legislation in. California almost did. Oregon almost did. Washington State almost did. A lot of people are saying instead of having all these state-by-state fights, which could become very, very expensive, I talked to a representative from the Farm Bureau, and I said, do you understand how when consumers see millions and millions of dollars go into campaign after campaign to stop this labeling, how they could start to distrust the technology, saying, wait, why are you paying millions so that I don't know this is in my food?
Yeah, right. That's
and
the
he
issue.
Said, you know, that was probably he said it was probably a mistake from the beginning. He said there should have been a different approach to it.
And that was actually one of the questions that one of the farmers that Monica interviewed kind of asked Norbert. He said,
from the Illinois Farmers Union.
And he was kind of like, I guess I kind of don't understand, you know? I mean, because all this millions of dollars, you think it's a good product, then why wouldn't they label?
There's some food for thought in that.
Yes.
And they say that that's just bad marketing.
They said they probably should have taken a different approach from the beginning because they should have been proud of their product. So here we are.
Louisa Chu, Monica Ang, chewing.xyz. You can find the podcast. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. Let's talk about the dress code stuff. This was a story that popped up last week, and it brings back, it kind of brings just a bad taste in your mouth about policies here in Chicago that this story seems to sort of pop up. Every other year, there's something that pops up about someone who wasn't let into a club because of some strange code. Mm-hmm. So we'll talk about that coming up here on The Download. Stay with us. It's The Download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Chewing in studio, Louisa Chu, Monica Ang. Louisa Chu is a Chicago Tribune food writer. Monica Ang works for the local public radio station, both covering food. They have a podcast together, Chewing. You find it at chewing.xyz.
And I want to say that was Thank you for choosing that. That was Neil Young's Monsanto Years, his song about Monsanto.
I thought we were going to sing along for a minute there.
That's
at least
him.
Monica was.
Talking about DJ. Call me a DJ. That's our DJ, a resident DJ. If you stick around long enough tonight, he's going to throw out like neon glow sticks.
Wow.
Right.
And he gets EDM. He's very EDM as he gets later into the night. All right. So, well, you know, we were talking about GMOs. Let's switch to Chicago food, restaurants, and bars. Obviously, the story, which was about 2 weeks ago now, a gentleman tried to get into a popular bar on the West Loop called Parlor.
Well, it's actually not just a bar. It's a
pizza
Parlor
restaurant, right.
Pizza Bar. It is actually a pizza restaurant that serves Neapolitan-style pies as well as being a sports bar. And so this story came up because this man wanted to watch game two of the NBA playoffs with his wife. And he was denied entry by security, who told him that his pants were too street. And so the issue came up because then he and his wife were puzzled and left. And then notice outside where they have a big open patio.
It's packed,
that,
by the way. Yeah.
Usually that place is packed. I mean, it's one of these, big corner. It's right in the West Loop on the corner of Green and Washington, right across from the Soho House.
It's right
hotel.
In the place in... that they just all have to build in.
Exactly.
Just one block in Chicago you have to build in. Right. It's the West Loop right there. Every restaurant, every worn factory is like, that door right there is now a barbecue place. That place, let's do ramen. That place, something
it
else.
It is the black hole of hipness in Chicago. And so open bar, and they noticed that people were wearing much more casual clothing than he was wearing. So they were questioning about perhaps that this was based on something else.
What's that something
else? Well, they alleged, the whole point was actually they filed a complaint with the City of Chicago's Human Rights Commission.
Right.
He's black. Alleging, yes, he's black, as is his wife, racial discrimination. And so the story came out that his pants, which I reported they were wool blend trousers made by a fashion brand called Vince that appeared to be sweatpants. And so here's the thing that's kind of puzzling to them as well as when I was reporting it, was at the restaurant itself, there's a very small sign that says appropriate attire required or something.
Right.
I don't remember the exact wording in there, but appropriate apparel.
No fancy sweatpants.
Well, not specifically, but on the website, actually, it has a whole list of after 5 o'clock, certain types of clothing are not allowed. No oversized clothing, no sweatpants was one of the things that was not allowed. And so they were questioning that. So the whole story came up. And as you were saying earlier, it's not so much the issue of alleged racial discrimination, but people were complaining about the price of the sweatpants.
Well,
or the alleged sweatpants.
Like I said, it seems like this kind of rears its head in Chicago, especially at nightclubs.
Exactly.
Often. And unfortunately, and I don't have the answer, and I don't want to insinuate anything, but it always seems to surround a black patron who can't get in because they're not dressed appropriately. And it kind of reeks in a way, because you're like, wait a second, these are $250 pants, man.
And the whole point is that, also is that we should not necessarily care about how much the price of pants are, because, of course, Monica wearing her fine ensemble of, sure, I'm guessing, $750 pair of jeans.
Yeah.
Salvation Army.
Exactly. We should first point out that dress codes are allowed in the City of Chicago, but they need to be enforced completely.
Uniformly.
There can't be an indiscriminate enforcement.
So that's by the city. Well, that's what the city's approach is, or their stance is, that if you have a dress code, it has to be uniform. You can't just pick and choose.
Correct. It needs to be
consistently. Seems to be happening at Parlor, because as I saw on Facebook, everybody who wrote anything took a picture of when they were in their running shoes and their workout outfits or whatever, what have you.
Yeah. And so when I spoke with the Human Rights Commissioner here in Chicago, I asked, of course, about some similar cases that have been settled by the city, that have been explored and investigated by the city. So there was a few years ago in Chicago, Mother's Nightclub, for example, where there were college students who came to Chicago and they approached the door and the black college student was not allowed in because he was told that his pants were too baggy.
Yeah.
And so he and his friend, who was a white college student, then exchanged the exact same pair of pants. Oh. And in fact, the white student was smaller and the pants were even bigger on him. And he went right back around and he was allowed in wearing the pants that were even baggier. So that was a separate case that was already investigated.
Let me ask you this, though. Parler, what I was surprised was the emphatic doubling down by Parler where they said, we have a strict dress code and we adhere by it. Sorry, deal with it. Mm-hmm. Like, there wasn't this sort of idea
my
that,
bad.
Or my bad, or, you know, it's at nighttime and we didn't know they were expensive pants or any sort of olive branch. They really, the management kind of put out a trite statement that was like, you know, if you want to be in our bar, we expect you to dress according to the rules.
Right. They released a statement saying that they wanted an elevated experience. And so, and again, they are allowed to have dress codes and they're allowed to have them at a certain time. For example, again, this is 5 o'clock and after, as long as it's consistently enforced. And not only do they have the location in the West Loop, which is kind of, as we were saying, sort of the nexus of hip and hipsterism, but they also just opened a second location on Division in Wicker Park, another nexus of a lot of people who might be wearing
clothing. It kind of reminds me of a story. I used to write a column in the Chicago Tribune called Food and Wine, and that's W-H-I-N-E, where people would write in about their complaints about restaurants. And there was a fairly well-known person in the Chicago theater community who had recently undergone chemotherapy. So she was wearing a hat. She went to lunch with a very well-known person, Richard Christensen, in the Chicago theater community. They went to Kiefer for lunch. They would not allow her in the dining room
while wearing
with
a hat?
Her cap on.
Huh.
And he said it was a terrible experience. And so I called them for the story, and they said, I'm sorry, but people in gangs wear hats in the Kiefer. I said, she had cancer. She was recovering from
chemotherapy. But at least in that case, they're like, hey, we got to, they probably were like, okay, for discrimination purposes, anyone who wears a hat.
Yeah, maybe that was the uniform code.
Yeah.
But I just, and then I called Miss Manners and they said, well, no, women aren't supposed to take off hats in dining rooms. Only men should. And that was, you know, kind of a throwback.
It's an interesting problem, you know, because I'm just, maybe it's worth a segment, like another segment about nightclubs and attire. And what's acceptable and what's not, because that just seems like there was a lot that went into that story that just seemed like it was leaning towards, you know, a person not being allowed because of their race. But mm-hmm. I also watched the news report and I mm-hmm. read the story and I also scratched my head a little bit. Mm-hmm. I'm like, there's a couple of things missing in this story that I'm not sure what's happening.
Well, here. I'm definitely going to be continuing to report on that because of the claim was just filed. It's going to be investigated by the city, and there still is an opportunity for response on both sides. So it is very interesting. And again, we should clarify, people can have dress codes. And I reported in the story, too, the wife in this situation had said, too, you can have dress codes. You can say nobody can wear anything purple, but it just needs to be consistently enforced.
You know, I used to tell this story when I was 23, mm-hmm. right? Went to a bar on Southport. Forgot the name of it. And I went up to the door and I was with somebody who had a ticket or didn't have their ID or something like that, right? And they were like, and I was advocating for that person. I was like, you know, no, they're fine, man. Just the ticket works. And the guy grabs my ID and he goes, the ticket's fine. You can't come in. This bar is 25 and up.
What?
Mm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'd never heard of a bar like that.
Yeah. It was a 25 and up, like, we don't want young 21-year-olds on the strip in Southport. Oh. I was a respectable 23,
right.
Louisa.
Yeah.
They didn't know.
I was mature. I was mature. I had a day job. Like, I had a collared shirt on, yeah. You know? Like, I was offended that I was grouped in with these hoodlum 21-year-olds.
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Then,
so I know I feel discrimination.
You go.
I just got mad at the guy and I went to Justin's like a block up. So
right.
Appropriately.
Where everybody knows your name.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That's beautiful.
All right. We'll take a break for the news. We'll come back. Let's talk about lead in not only the schools, but the park districts. Mm-hmm. And then let's also talk about what we would eat. Sound
and
good?
Not eat.
And not eat, right. Monica Eng, Louisa Chu, chewing.xyz. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio tonight, two of my favorite people, Louisa Chu, Monica Eng, chewing. It should be chewing.
Yeah, right. Chewang.
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 Right. Well, that might be appropriate for our later conversation.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so chewing.xyz is where you can find the podcast. How often do you put them out? Every other week?
Every two weeks.
Every 2 weeks.
Last Friday, we put out our GMO podcast, and then this next, not today, but a week from today.
You need that much time to savor.
We're putting out our, is it the cooks and books,
it's
or is
actually
it
fat
animals?
Books, because we talk to Fat Rice chefs, owners, and new authors. They've got a book coming out, Abe Conlon and Adrian Lowe. Mm-hmm. And we happen
That's
to be
great.
Able to, yeah, so we got a preview of their new bakery and speakeasy space, as well as we talked to them and had them taste a surprise jelly bean.
Rotting fish flavored
no,
jelly bean.
It was not rotting fish. The
dead
new,
fish, sorry.
Right. Dead fish, which is kind of thematic.
That's what I mean. Yeah. And in the podcast, there's much more of this, the arguing with each other. That's the part I miss on WGN.
I
like the podcast when you're arguing with each other.
I think a discussion. I prefer to thoughtful,
provocative. Louisa will even argue with you
discussion.
About whether you can call it arguing.
No, not at all.
Anyway.
All right, let's talk about lead in the water in schools. That's what we were just talking about for the last month.
Yeah.
But it's going to make a transition here, and you broke this story, that you know what we should do for the summer is be checking for lead in the park district.
I want to bring people down wherever they go. So now that the kids are out of school, in 1 week, July 6th, they start day camp. I'm a park district day camp kid. Went pretty much my whole childhood.
Park District family. Yeah,
yeah. And 40,000 Chicago children will be enrolling in summer camps in 2 weeks. Well, less than 2 weeks. And so I asked what a lot of people would ask, hey, what are you guys doing about the fountains in the park district?
It is the fountain, because those are a lot. The parks are a little bit more run down. You've got drinking fountains. You know, where's that water coming from? I mean, there's a lot. That's actually a real sort of... That's a good place to look for lead in the water.
Absolutely. And so I didn't hear back. And actually, I'm working with Curious City at the public radio station, and someone wrote in and said, I jog along that path. Can you tell me where I can find stats on park district fountains? Finally, they got back to me and they said, well, I'll tell you, Monica, we're checking. We're doing a pilot in 60 field houses across the city, and we're doing 20 in the north, 20 central, 20 south. I didn't know that the park district were broken down by three regions, but they're taking an equal amount from each, and they say they hope to have the results by July. I said, before the kids start camp? They are not answering whether or not it will be before the kids start camp.
Well, they start right after the 4th of July, right?
Right.
And that's right at, so they're not going to have the results by the 4th of July.
They might. But they're not saying. And I think that's really crucial, because I think a lot of parents, before sending your kid on a 90-degree day to camp, would like to know if they checked the water.
Wow. Well, that is interesting, because, you know, that kind of information would be useful. But let's be frank. I mean, there's probably going to be lead in some of that water. If the schools had the rate that they had, the park district's field houses, which are much older, are going to have the same rate.
Well, it's very interesting, because as I pressured CPS to please, please check, and they kept, you know, saying, speak to the hand, don't bother me. When they finally decided to do it, they're like, fine, out of an abundance of caution, we will check. But Forrest Claypool actually said, I don't think we're going to find anything. And now we see that I believe the latest one was 27 or 29 schools have not just lead, but lead that exceeds, and in some cases far exceeds, what the EPA
now. How
will
many?
To
I mean, there's a percentage there, because 27, 28, 29 schools.
So about 30%. So they have 90 something that they've released the results on,
right.
And 20. I believe 29 elevated levels.
Is that a big enough sample size to start testing other schools? I mean, obviously 90 is just a small percentage of
right.
this district.
So after I badgered them, they said, okay, fine, we'll do a pilot. We'll do 28 schools.
And all of your stories are like, after I badgered them.
Basically, my job is to be a pain in the neck.
Why don't we? That's a new podcast. After I badgered right. them with Monica.
That's your job?
After Monica irritated
hobby.
Them enough, they said, fine. If you just stop it, we'll check 28 schools. And they only found one in that pilot program. But they said, because we found one, I guess we'll find more. And now they're finding about a third consistently, a third of all the results that they release have schools with these dangerous, you know, very, actually in many cases, very dangerous levels of lead in the water. And one of the worst was at a school for developmentally disabled kids ages 2 through 6. These kids already have some issues they're dealing with, and to be drinking water with lead at, I believe, 22 times the federal limit. That's just not good.
Well, to the, I mean, this is not a situation where it's necessarily corruption that Chicago Public Schools is trying to, they recognized that 20 years ago and they're like, well, look the other way. This is something that just because of Flint, Michigan, and because of the issues that came up, they're like, oh, we should check our system. It's inevitable because those buildings were built so long ago and the pipes underneath the buildings, there's going to be some lead. What do you do now? If you're CPS expensive. With no money, how do you take care of lead in the water if a school tests positive?
There is some federal legislation to put aside some money for remediation and at least for testing. I believe Charles Schumer out of New York has proposed putting some money toward getting schools checked. Because, you know, it's not an evil thing. It's not an evil conspiracy. The fact is they've had bigger fish to fry. They've had more immediate problems. And so this always went on the back burner. But with Flint, it got a lot of people checking. And honestly, LA and New York have been dealing with lead remediation in their schools for the last decade. Hmm. So it's about time that we at least caught up and started checking.
A Texas came in and said, why don't you sick Friends of the Park on them?
They seem to have some clout around here.
All right. We'll continue the conversation here with Louisa Chu and Monica Ng. We'll take a quick break. When we come back, we'll wrap up with a segment
It's going to be a doozy.
Yeah. It's a download here on WGN Radio. We're wrapping up another great hour with Louisa Chu and Monica Ng. Chewing, the podcast which comes out every other week at chewing.xyz. You can find it on iTunes. You can also find it at chicagotribune.com/chewing podcast. Mm-hmm. So we talked about we had four topics to get to tonight. We talked about, let's recap. Are you ready for the recap? Mm-hmm. I'll do my Doogie Howser. We talked about GMOs and the big movement this week, or non-movement, in Congress and the Senate. We talked about dress codes and appropriate conduct at bars when we talk about what happened with the wool sweatpants. Don't ever buy wool sweatpants.
Not for 200.
We just talked about lead in the schools, but also lead possibly in the water at Chicago Park District, which is a big issue because camp's starting a week. And so we end with a segment we've been doing where a couple weeks ago you guys had me try a terrible, like really old egg.
Right, no. 1,000-year-old egg.
Right, yeah. Which is a specialty of Chinese cuisine. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Delicious, very meaty. Mm-hmm. Speaking of meaty,
meaty Chinese.
All right, so let's talk about the one that you guys are thinking about today. There's no taste test, but what's the issue?
So our former colleague at the Chicago Tribune, Kevin Peng, he went to the Beijing Olympics 8 years ago, and he went to a very special type of restaurant that served nothing but penises from many different animals. And he and Bill Plaschke, I believe, who is the LA Times sports columnist, they went together and they tried a lamb penis, they tried a bull penis. And then when it came time for a black dog penis, they had ethical issues because they'd had dogs growing up.
Right.
And so we did an interview, 8 years later with Kevin to see if he regretted his decision to abstain. And I can't tell you because you'll have to listen to the podcast to hear about his thoughts or regrets that moment.
I don't want to hear about Kevin Peng's regrets about not eating a dog penis.
Well, it's our animal style episode. And so we kind of talk about the
do we
ethics
only
of that.
From eating cute
did you
things?
Guys right. get real passionate and dramatic where you're like, Kevin, do you regret?
Take me back.
Take me back.
How were you feeling?
How were you feeling when you bit into the lamb penis? All right, so let me. What I'm interested in is the delicacy. Is it something that's high end? Was it a high end restaurant? Was it more like a shop? What was the restaurant experience?
It was a hot pot restaurant, and that's where they bring you out raw meats and raw vegetables, and you dip them in the broth and you cook them.
Okay.
And Well, I can.
Wait,
I
the
can,
hot pot you're eating already?
No, just the idea that it's raw.
Raw,
yeah.
Right,
sliced.
Kind of in discs and slices.
Penises.
And
yeah.
So, right. So he.
Right. There are
so
always delicacies when they're like that.
And you can go on YouTube, actually, and look for that video. I believe it's, you look for Bill Plaschke, if you remember how to spell that LA Times writer's name, eating dog penis. You can find that on YouTube right
Come
now.
Come on, man.
And their whole discussion.
Don't
and,
do it at work.
And we basically, we talked to Kevin as a way to launch a discussion about how do we decide what's okay to eat and what's mm-hmm. not okay to eat? Is it all just cute things aren't okay to eat?
Well, especially because as I am the guardian of a black dog, you know, we sort of propose
don't let
that
Kevin go near no, it.
A black boy dog, actually, too. You know, we sort of discuss that about whether or not we would eat dog or penises. And I mean, and Monica being the guardian of two adopted bunny rabbits, two black bunny rabbits, they were actually originally destined to be food on a farm. I mean, where do we draw those lines? And so I think it's, you know, and especially actually right now, it kind of came up because I'm sure many people have seen now on social media. Now, again, it is the time of the Chinese Yulin Dog Festival, which is highly controversial because of the way that the dogs are treated or mistreated, and specifically for, again, these, you know, very virile purposes for eating these dogs as well as at these penis restaurants. And yet here in this country, and I know we've talked about this before, especially for the egg episode, we are a culture that finds it acceptable to grind up live fluffy yellow baby boy chicks. And so what are the
because
differences?
Because they're not useful as layer hens.
Right. So that was for our egg episode, which is why we brought in the egg that time. So
yeah, there's a, I mean, there's ethical question about it, and it's the 10-year-old boy in me is just dying laughing.
Of course.
I'm dying laughing at this.
I you mean, know,
but I mean, is I hesitate to even ask the question of, I mean, the consistency, or it's a hot pot, so you...
He said, well, I got him to describe in loving detail the consistency. He said, gristly, tendony, chewy, not much flavor, but very gelatinous. Mm-hmm. He said, pretty
right.
gelatinous.
Right.
And actually, if you go to Tank Noodle at Broadway and Argyle, they do have one special pho, one special beef noodle soup that they call cow penis, which is not possible. You guys need to change that menu. But it you see little buttons in there. Little round things.
All right.
Things.
And I gotta say, if you like breaded and deep fried those, they'd
yeah,
sell
right.
like yeah,
at the fair
cakes. Exactly. Maybe yeah. right. Exactly. That
you
would
fry
be great.
Stick.
At a street
funnel.
Festival.
Exactly.
Right. Funnel,
funnel
cakes
made out of penises.
Tacos,
yes.
And then you've got the penises. Louisa Chu, Monica Ang. Chewing is the podcast. You can find it at chewing.xyz. It's every other week. You can also find it at chicagotribune.com/chewingpodcast. Great to see you guys. See you in a couple weeks.
Thanks, man.
Justin.
Great to see you too.
It's a download here on WGN Radio. Yeah, I'm not sure I'm going to. I'm glad that there wasn't a taste test. Could you imagine?
Ugh. Yeah, just the thought of it.
Just I know, right? I think that's probably there's probably nobody with any other thought. You know what I mean? It's not like there's somebody out there that's listening right now like, "No, I think that'd be tasty." Oh yeah, that would be I would definitely eat that. I'd definitely eat penis.
No.
No. That's just not a thing.
No.
How are sports teams doing tonight? The Cubs won.
It's over. This just in, Justin. The Cubs have snapped their four-game losing streak.
Cubs won.
Woo! In a miraculous 5-4 win over the Marlins. Here's the thing, though. Pete and I were talking about this behind the scenes while you were doing your show down there. That at one point in time, the Marlins had four runs off one hit. You know what that means.
Was it a grand slam?
Yes.
Like in the first or second inning or something?
Well,
like that?
Pete actually had more details on it than I did. Pete, what was the situation?
A couple of walks and an
right.
error.
There you go.
And then the grand slam.
Yeah, you know, but they, I mean, it looked like the Cubs launched out. They scored four in the first, right? And then it was, then they didn't score again until later in the game. Right?
Mm-hmm. Top of the seventh.
How about my White Sox? What
How
did
about
they do?
Them? They're leading right now.
Come on, turn it around.
They are up 3-2 in the top of the eighth inning on the south side against the Blue Jays, eh?
Hey. Hey, oh, by the way, we didn't even talk about this. Andrew Shaw going to the Canadiens.
Right.
How do you like that?
Well, you know, it's all right. He's, you know, I think people are making more of it than they probably should.
Andrew Shaw's a great guy. He was fun to have here, but there, let's be honest, there are a million Andrew Shaws in the league.
Well, that's what I noticed, especially towards the end of the first round of the playoffs. Andrew Shaw was both a spark plug and a detriment.
Oh, he was a liability, no doubt.
Yeah, there was he had that huge penalty that wouldn't
he took two stupid penalties in that series against the Blues, and
not to mention made national news by throwing terrible words around on national television. But you know, he was a fan favorite because he was always scrappy. Mm-hmm. He's a scrappy player, and he's the kind of guy that would headbutt a puck into the. And he seemed to have a fighting spirit, he had that kind of hockey spirit. So it's sad to see him go, but at the same time, I think you're right. He's replaceable piece, and if he has to go for the Hawks to be able to free up some space, he wanted $4 million.
That's right, Justin, the scrappy player out of Belleville, Ontario, on his way to Les Habitants. How will he do in the province of Quebec?
I saw all the news coming out about him being shipped to Montreal. I'm like, why? And everybody was on Twitter. It's like they're all upset about it. I'm like, oh man, why are people upset? So I looked him up, and I was actually thinking it was Andrew Ladd.
Oh, right. He's already gone.
Yeah, I had the whole play. I was like, oh, I had the wrong player. Yeah, I like that guy. I like that Shaw guy.
Shaw's the guy who's missing a tooth.
Yeah,
he's always missing teeth. He's Duncan Keith wannabe. You know, but he was great for the Blackhawks, and I enjoyed watching him. And he definitely brought a lot of energy, and that's what you always hope can be replaced, is that sort of X factor of whether or not guys, when the blood is pumping and it's late in the third, who's going to step up, who's going to be that kind
of
guy.
So. He's done well for himself. His name's on the Stanley Cup. He was loved here in and out of the locker room. And not only that, but he goes to another Heritage franchise. I mean, the guy's really under a lucky star right now.
I was going to say, for the Canadians, what do they need? I mean, how do they get better with Andrew Shaw?
Well,
you follow. The only reason I ask that is because you follow the Canadians.
You look at a guy like P.K. Subban, who's on their back end. He's one of their he is their top defenseman. Shaw provides a bit more grit on a team that I think this past season really didn't have a whole lot of that. I mean, look. There was not one Canadian-based team that made the postseason this year.
Yeah, that's crazy. And you know what else is crazy? Did I hear it right that Patrick Kane's the first guy to win the Hart Trophy that's not Canadian?
I think he was the first American-born
player.
That could be correct.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Isn't the Hart Trophy the MVP of hockey?
It is.
So it's been dominance by Canadian players for that long?
Well, and other foreign-born players, yes.
Yeah, and foreign-born players.
But, I mean, you figure a guy like Madonna, Roenick.
Right.
I mean, and they were great players.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned two. The American-born players.
There are more. The Mullins.
Okay.
And, I could go on and on. Brett Hull.
Oh, Brett Hull, yeah. Well,
I can keep going.
You couldn't keep going.
I'd have to Google it, but I can keep going.
All right. Coming up, we're going to get some live music, some Irish jazz in studio, replacing the frying pan, which has taken the night off. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Program note, the frying pan, which usually is in this slot Friday nights at 10, is taking a week off. Steve Gadlin, our local entrepreneur and innovator, he is out of town, so he is out for this week. He'll be back next Friday, but that's okay because we have replaced him with professionals. Musicians. Coming up this Monday night, Irish jazz musician Cormac McCarthy will be celebrating the release of his new Cottage Evolution CD at Martyrs on the north side on Lincoln Avenue. McCarthy is a jazz musician, but he also blends classical and traditional Irish music into his compositions. The show is being put on by the Irish Music School of Chicago, an organization that is dedicated to passing on the living tradition of Irish music, song, and dance. In studio with me, Cormac McCarthy. He's on the keys. Sean Cleland on fiddle, Robert McLeod on fiddle. Thanks for being here, guys. Appreciate it.
It's
Delighted.
All right, so why don't we just start with music? I mean, what are we going to hear here? Sean, what are we going to hear?
We're going to play two slip jigs, A Fig for a Kiss and The Kid, as in a goat kid on the mountain.
All right, here we go. 5 in the All-Stage Showcase Studio. Cormac McCarthy on piano, Sean Cleland on fiddle, Robert McLeod on fiddle. They're part of the Cormac McCarthy's band that's going to be playing at Martyrs on Monday the 27th, also part of the Irish Music School of Chicago. The 6th annual Francis O'Neill Irish Arts Week starts this Sunday. We'll talk about all that stuff because there's a lot to talk about. Cool. The show. We're going to hear some more music here. Let's take a quick break. We stay on, keep the trains on time, running on time here. Cool. And we'll come back and we'll talk a little bit and hear some more live music. Awesome. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio in studio tonight. Woo-hoo! Some great Irish musicians. Cormac McCarthy from Cork, Ireland, a pianist. He is here in town for the 6th annual Francis O'Neill Irish Arts Week, which starts this Sunday. He's going to be having a CD release party at Martyrs on Monday night. The CD is Cottage Evolution. Also in studio, Sean Cleland and Robert McLeod, fiddler. fiddlers,
yes,
if you will. So Cormac, welcome back to Chicago, because you spent some time here in school, right?
That's right, Justin. Yeah, I did my master's in jazz composition at DePaul.
So you know, it's just interesting to me, and we were kind of talking about it in the break a little bit, but I don't think of piano, especially jazz, but I don't think of piano when I think of traditional Irish music.
Yeah, you're right, but I mean, the thing about it is so many of the instruments that are played in Irish traditional music have been integrated over time, you know.
Like fiddles,
yeah. Exactly. They weren't there at the beginning either.
Really?
So, yeah, I mean, you know, things kind of, the tradition moves on, I guess.
What's the when we say traditional Irish music, what are the instruments that are mostly associated with the origins of
well, there's
that?
A bowron, which is a kind of a drum made from goat skin, and I guess that
it's the frame drum. It's the Irish frame drum.
That would be, like anything where it's drumming and singing was kind of the origination of it all, but... And then accordions came in from Italy, and
flutes,
you know,
and whistle things came in.
Yeah, it came in from Europe. I mean, Ireland's so closely linked to Europe
right.
You know, by trade over, you know, so there's always been these links.
Trade and occupation.
Yeah.
Well, where does the jazz come from for you? I mean, you spent time here in Chicago. Chicago, obviously a big jazz town, but where does the jazz inspiration come for you?
Well, I think there was just always jazz playing at home. My dad is actually a traditional musician, but he would have been very interested in jazz. Through him, really, there was always jazz records playing in the house.
What kind of stuff would you listen to?
He was big into the ECM jazz kind of scene, which I guess was big in the 80s and 70s and 80s. So that's when he would have been kind of maturing,
Jack
I guess.
And all those guys.
Keith Jarrett and all these guys. So I kind of got an entry into it that way. And then in Cork, where I'm from, there's actually a big international jazz festival.
Right.
So I had access to hear all the best jazz musicians in the world every October. So that was pretty cool.
For you, I mean, to make a move to be a jazz musician, Irish jazz musician, I mean, you really have to almost, what's it like to be an Irish jazz musician? I mean, is there a scene that's happening?
There is a scene, there actually is a scene. There's a guitarist, Louis Stewart, who would have really pioneered a lot of it, and he was world-class guitarist. But there's a scene there, and it's actually going from strength to strength. But and more so, it's becoming more integrated into the Irish traditional music scene as well, where there's a bit of crossover happening. And I think there's a whole new, I guess, jazz genre almost stemming out of Ireland at the moment, which is kind of interesting.
And yeah, it is.
Again, purists on both sides aren't going to like it, but, you know, but that's okay.
but I wonder why not, because it is interesting in the way that you hear the jazz, especially with the piano. You hear the sort of more traditional stuff with the fiddle. So it seems like, you know, if you are a traditionalist or a purist on either side, you may be open to it.
Well, and luckily we're hosting this event and we live in Chicago, so we can, because we're in the new world, as it were. We're playing music from Ireland as Americans of Irish descent. So we're already circumspect. So why not, you know, do what we want to do? And if this is an arts festival, why not do some cool,
interesting stuff,
things,
right?
that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, we hold the line pretty strongly on trying to teach really traditional. By traditional, I don't want that to sound like a not fun or not great thing. It's just an amazing thing.
There's just a lot of integrity in what you guys teach. And I think
I was going to say, when I think of traditional and then you say Irish,
but I don't want it to
dance,
sound stern.
Song, that's not stern.
Me,
it's great.
It's joyous and it's
there's
it's
a lot
uplifting.
Of traditional stuff that I know that's not great. But Irish traditional with
it's
the fiddles.
Proud
and, oh,
and
so
body
good.
And it's all these things. And it's familial based and it's multi-generational. It's all these things that is an American of Irish descent, I always felt and gravitated towards.
Well, you know, I've only been to Ireland one time in my life, and the one thing I was lucky to have was that experience where you go into a bar or a pub, and in there are musicians playing.
Yeah.
You know, someone's on fiddle, someone's on the drum, as you mentioned. There's a little bit more. There's just this authentic feel, even and more so than you get in the States, in the way that, you know, that might be more organized in the States, you know, where there's a band in the back of a room. But talk about how that influences your music, the idea of improvisation or getting together with musicians who you don't necessarily always play with, but you play with in a common space like a pub.
Yeah, well, I think the thing about Irish traditional music is that it's very social-based music, you know, and it's very open. So I guess that would have influenced things. And as a result, I've always tried to play with people who I get along with.
It's really important.
Yeah. So even for this album that I've released, there's 12. It's a 12-piece ensemble for most of the album. But those players I kind of wrote the music specifically for the players, not really for the instruments. I obviously knew what instruments they played, but it was based more on their personalities and their specific ways of playing. And I tried to go about it that way, really, which is has led to it being its own thing. You know, if I set out just to write for a certain instrumentation, it would have been something different, but it's very much about the personalities.
Well, the show's at Martyrs on Monday night. It's a CD release party for Cottage Evolution, the new album by Cormac McCarthy. He plays piano. Sean Cleland and Robert McLeod are playing fiddle. What are we going to hear here? Let's hear one of your tracks.
I'll play a tune called Den Roach's Cross. It's the name of a place in Cork City where I lived for a while. I'll go for
it. All right, here it is on the download. Live in studio, Cormac McCarthy,
awesome.
Irish pianist who is playing at Martyrs on Monday night, CD release party for Cottage Evolution. It's a part of the 6th annual Francis O'Neill Irish Arts Week, which starts this Sunday, which we're going to talk about. We'll take a break for the news here, but I want to talk about the festival, about what you guys have planned, and maybe get one more track out of you guys.
Yeah,
that would be great. In studio, Cormac McCarthy, Sean Cleland, Robert McLeod. Again, the 6th annual Francis O'Neill Irish Arts Week starts this Sunday. We'll be back. Stay with us. Yeah, it's a download here on WGN Radio. Coming up at 11 o'clock, Patty Vasquez with Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. This here is the download. Coming up on Monday night, Irish jazz musician Cormac McCarthy will be celebrating the release of his new Cottage Evolution CD. It's going to be at Martyrs on the north side on Lincoln Avenue. McCarthy, a jazz musician, but he also blends classical and traditional Irish music into his compositions. In studio, Cormac McCarthy, Sean Cleland, who is a fiddle player, Robert McLeod. This is all part of the 6th annual Francis O'Neill Irish Arts Week, which starts this Sunday. Francis O'Neill
was a young man initially that left Ireland when he was 15 or 16. He had been educated, and he left because he wanted to see the world, which was kind of unusual for that time. If you remember, it's right after the Great Hunger, the Great Famine. He was a sailor. He sailed all over the world. He did a bunch of jobs. He ended up working in Chicago as a young man. He came here probably to work at the stockyards, but soon thereafter he became a policeman. Why this is all important, though, is because he was also a traditional Irish musician. He played the flute and the fiddle, and he sang songs. And he came to Chicago right when Chicago was rebuilding after the Great Fire, and right when Chicago was really, like, the first skyscrapers were when he was a young man and all these things. And he got really filled with that spirit. Plus, he was filled with dismay over the state of that everyone leaving Ireland, and he decided to collect tunes and save them, to do the best collection of Irish dance music and that had ever been done. And he had the wherewithal and the capacity as the chief of police to do this, and he self-financed this book. So it's a total Chicago story, this guy.
Yeah,
he's buried in Mount Olivet Cemetery
Which is going to be part of the festival. Tell me about this. This is so interesting.
This is a very Irish thing to do. Like in Ireland, you would often on a feast day, but a local musician or somebody, not just musicians, you might go to their grave on their anniversary and play some tunes and in their honor, right, Cormac? You do that, yeah. Absolutely. Like Cormac's Sean Arrieta is a good case of a Cork musician where you would go and you'd play at his grave. And so we do this at Francis O'Neill. We start off this year, we're starting at Mrs. Murphy's and Sons and having brunch. Then Cormac is going to give a little talk because Cormac's from West Cork himself, and hop in a bus, go to Mount Olivet Cemetery, talk about Irish history in Chicago, play some tunes for the chief, meet Kevin Henry, our good friend, our icon of Chicago music for the last 50 years, head back to Mrs. Murphy's and have a session.
That's great. You know, for all the years that I've lived in Chicago and I've known Chief O'Neill's and I never knew that story.
I mean, that's what Chief O'Neill's.
I knew Chief O'Neill's. I mean,
and it's owned by two musicians who named it in honor of this titan.
Interesting.
I mean, he's an Irish story. He's an American story, too. And that's why we named the camp after him.
Who evidently actually rose to chief of police in the Chicago Police Force, which is. I think that's what people back home are nearly most interested in. Whoa, he was chief of police in Chicago, which is
when most of the people here were German. Like the biggest ethnic group were Germans, so he.
Cormac, you spent some time here. You came here to go to DePaul. What do people know about Chicago in Cork? I mean, and the music scene here. I mean, you got your master's here in music from DePaul. Talk about that the merge of taking what you learned in Cork, what you learned here, and bringing it back.
Yeah, well, I suppose it is iconic as a kind of a jazz and blues city. I mean, it's even when I was saying to people I was going to be moving to Chicago. Instantly people said, oh, jazz and blues, you know, no wonder you're going there, because I was always interested in jazz and, you know, I really wanted to try and really, you know, fine-tune my skills as much as possible. So, I came over and, I mean, I started, went to DePaul, started playing lots of jazz, but I also met Sean and met some other traditional musicians in the city and continued playing Irish traditional music as well. And to be honest, there was a platform there. It was while I was here, those 2 years, that I really started to. It wasn't a conscious decision to actually focus in on blending different styles together. It just started to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And for better or for worse, it happened. And I started to really enjoy it, and audiences seemed to like it, and people enjoyed playing it.
Did you get the opportunity? I mean, I mentioned earlier about, you know, the sort of Irish music experience in pubs. In Chicago, jazz music is in a similar vein.
Absolutely.
When, you know, like open mics and other places. Were you able to take that in when you were at DePaul?
Yeah, big time. Actually, funny enough, we just came straight from a jazz jam in Ravenswood. Sean picked me up and came straight down here. Yeah, so we were at the Rodham Club in Ravenswood playing jazz until about half an hour ago. So it's, yeah.
So,
and
yeah.
I've experienced that as well. And I mean, it's.
Are they similar? I mean, I guess it is similar if you just kind of pull it all back as musicians jamming in a bar, right?
I think so, especially actually what we came from earlier, where it's informal, and it's more, you know, you just have, you talk between the songs, and you know, you just have a bit of fun with friends effectively, or people that you're sharing the same musical space and the same physical space, and it's just, there's a connection starts to happen. And it's very similar to traditional music.
Well, the traditional Irish music and jazz do share similarities when you talk about improvisation. You know, the jazz is built on the idea of just picking up a vibe or a sort of chord structure and just going with it. How similar is that to the idea of playing some Irish traditional music where it's sort of like, hey, we're going to play this, let's go?
Well, I think what's important is that they're both very orally based. So, like, you know, a lot of tunes that were initially in jazz, especially.
Orally, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and I mean, you know, playing by ear is also a big part of both,
right.
Both genres. So, I mean, there's a common ground shared there, as opposed to, let's say, classical music, where it's, you know, generally you're reading off a page.
Or even rock music.
Or even rock music, to a certain extent. Yeah. So it's about quickly picking up things by ear and really, you know, having a quick ear and, you know, just all around musicianship. And equally, I mean, people mightn't associate Irish traditional music with improvisation, but it is actually a huge part of the music, where people do variations on the existing melody, and sometimes these variations can be pretty wildly removed from the melody.
Do you feel like, coming from that background, you know, with your father being a musician, more traditional Irish, did that help you when you started to become a jazz musician, of the same kind of understanding of the music?
I'm not sure, to be honest. And sometimes I feel like the time feel is quite different, and sometimes I felt like it almost inhibited me, but maybe that was just, I don't know, maybe that's my own hang up.
You just kept wanting to go back to
it was right. just the, wanted to emphasize certain parts of the beat and do little things, the phrasing slightly different. But what I've tried to do is actually, you know, discover both ways of playing and just see what comes out once you've really dug deep into both genres.
Sean, this festival, the Francis O'Neill, 6th Annual Francis O'Neill Irish Arts Week, it starts Sunday. What can we expect from it?
You can expect instruction for children and adults during the week at the Irish American Heritage Center starting on Monday. It goes 9 to 3 every day. And then evening events, there's evening events at the Irish American Heritage Center on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, and Saturday afternoon. And then we're doing our visit to the chief on Sunday and Cormac concert on Monday.
Okay. If you can't make the concert, you can download the album on iTunes.
Oh, yeah. There you go. Cottage Evolution.
And you can find all that stuff on our website, which is irishmusicschool.org. irishmusicschool.org.
Cormac McCarthy, Sean Cleland, Robert McLeod in studio. The 6th Annual Francis O'Neill Irish Arts Week starts Sunday. Monday night, the 27th, the CD release party for Cottage Evolution, Cormac McCarthy CD. It will be at Martyrs up on Lincoln, 3855 North Lincoln. What are we going to hear here, guys?
We're going to play two iconic, super traditional Irish reels that were popularized by a man from Galway that lived part of his adult life in Chicago named Joe Cooley. In fact, the first reel is called Joe Cooley's, and the second one is called The Wise Maid. And they're linked with this character who moved from Chicago right before I was born. But anyway.
All right, let's hear it.
All right.
2, 3, 4. Turn on the street. All right, there you go. Look at that. Michigan Avenue loves you. All right, Cormac McCarthy. This is great. Sean Cleland, Robert McLeod. They're all part of the Irish Music School of Chicago 6th Annual Francis O'Neill Irish Arts Week, which starts this Sunday. Cormac McCarthy is going to have the album release party at Martyrs. The album is Cottage Revolution. You can get it on iTunes. But they'll be at Martyrs on June 27th. That's Monday at 7 o'clock, 3855 North Lincoln. You guys, thanks very much for coming in. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Have a great show and a great festival.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it, man.
That was great. What a week. What a week, Pete. To end it that way, to have such a great ending with an Irish musician, some fiddle players talking about Francis O'Neill. Pretty great. What a show tonight, too. Started with an argument with Roe. That was fun. It's so funny because, you know, on Friday nights, Roe's got almost like a carnival of people in here. Rich Roper's in here. You know, a lot of times Susie's in here. There's a lot of people.
Producers, it's a people party. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's great. It's awesome. You walk in, there's like 9-10 people in here. And so, like, I walked in, and he's like, you, sit down. Like, he was ready to yell at me about this Friends of the Park stuff, because if you've paid attention to WGN, I don't know, if you paid attention to Crosstalks, mm-hmm. I don't know. You know, I have been on the record that I've been on the record even before the Lucas Museum. I've had Lee Bay in, who's going to come in next week again, to talk about this idea of the relationship between the public parks and the people of Chicago, and whether or not we should be building or privatizing.
Mm-hmm.
I will make other unpopular statements about things like Lollapalooza. We talked about it with Riot Fest. Chris Caskey from Pitchfork is coming up next week. I'd love to talk to him about it, mm-hmm. about the idea of being in a public park and charging people to be there. And I also feel like, you know, we've had a public doctrine. We've had a trust, which is a law, which is backed up by judges, that, you know what, we don't build private entities on public land. We don't do vanity projects on the lakefront, in our front yard.
So then how do you feel about the Obama Library?
Now, this is interesting, and I'm glad you brought that up. The Obama Library, at the beginning, the Friends of the Park went after the Obama Library.
I know.
But the issue was, and this is why I don't necessarily like what our state was able to come together on this. But before the Obama Library would be in Chicago, they passed a law in the State House that said that you could not sue if on the location of this place. So essentially, they went to.
Well, they did an end around, basically.
They knew it was going to be a suit. So Friends of the Park was blocked before, which is it's not unlike we were talking about with the GMOs. Why are you spending so much time, going around and spending time in the State House to come up with these laws that say that you can't be mad if we pick here? That's essentially it. And so to the defense of the Obama Library, there's a community attachment to it, in the sense that a library is not it's a community builder.
I understand where you're going with that, but you can also make a similar argument with the Lucas Museum. I'm sure there would have been built in to the construction of the museum many sort of community events and things where, you know, free days, so on and so forth, you know, that they have across the museum campus.
There's no doubt about it. That it's hard to defend. You know, there's something, and someone much more articulate and eloquent than I will make the difference. Maybe Lee can do it on Monday. But the Obama Library, a presidential library, fits into a different category than than someone coming in and wanting to set up a private museum. And I don't know what that category is. But I also agree that I wasn't keen on the Obama Library taking space, because they can't get that space back.
Right.
We have a lot of land in this city that, I mean, go down to the south and west sides and you'll see vacant lot among vacant lot. We're talking all the time about jobs and prosperity. I find it somewhat disconcerting to hear leaders like Reverend Jesse Jackson or leaders like Father Flager come out and say that we need the Lucas Museum of Narrative Art. You know, how dare you not have it? Because that museum, if we really need it, should be in neighborhoods. It should be in places that aren't necessarily on the lakefront, because we have to protect that lakefront, man.
And I agree. It's a shiny boggle, you know, what would have been the Lucas Museum along the lakefront. Mm-hmm. But as far as the Obama Library is concerned, if you truly want to do something along those lines, like you said, bulldoze blighted areas, wipe out those homes that are unoccupied.
Agreed.
And then integrate, because as we know, this is a fairly, you know, segregated city. Integrate, you know,
certain federal housing with nice condos and try to kind of manipulate things around the library that maybe could be a model moving forward.
Couldn't have said better myself, and I find it to be somewhat disingenuous from the president of the United States to know that issue in the city of Chicago, to know that we are trying to protect our parks against all costs. Because at the end of the day, as our planet moves on, we're going to want green space in the city of Chicago. That's what makes this an amazing city to live in. The fact that we have had the foresight as people who lived in this area to protect that. Some other cities in the Midwest did not. You know, some NBA championship cities did not. You know, but I mean, there was this idea that we were going to protect the lakefront for the people of Chicago so that the public can go to the public spaces.
Well, it is nice when you fly into either Midway or O'Hare, to your point, it is beautiful to see because you have pockets, obviously, of developed areas and then just these beautiful green spaces.
Yeah. I think that the argument that I find to be most challenging about this is that the Friends of the Park are somehow, you know, people are being cutesy. You know, friends, quote, you know, friends or friend enemies of the park. This is all they do. And they've been doing it for years. I mean, this is what they do. They just never get recognized because they're always a footnote. No one took them seriously. And we just act like there's some sort of do-gooder group that's, you know, picking up garbage along the river. And in this case, it was a federal judge that said, you know what, that's an interesting argument. I'll allow it. And yet, you know, because I think, and Blair Kamen points this out, at least George Lucas and Rahm Emanuel aren't pulling the Donald Trump move and criticizing a federal judge because they can't. You know, that's against sort of protocol. So instead, what they're doing is going after the little guy. But I was, you know, having a conversation with a friend earlier who said, if it wasn't Friends of the Park, it'd be somebody else. You know, it's not difficult to put a lawsuit in against this. We would not be all enjoying the jackhammers right now if the Friends of the Park didn't step forward. Somebody else would have, because this is something that we've been protecting for so long. And we were talking about earlier, what's stopping Woody Allen from coming here and setting up the Woody Allen Institute for cinema along the lakefront? What's stopping Richard Driehaus from taking
too many clarinets?
Too many clarinets. The whole wing, the clarinet wing. You know, what's stopping Kyle Petty from bringing all his NASCAR, you know, great cars he's had over the years, the Petty family?
See, now that I would totally endorse. Absolutely.
Put
NASCAR
it right down,
museum,
yeah,
are you
right,
kidding me?
Right there.
Absolutely.
You know, right between Soldier Field and the Field Museum.
I may be in the minority on this, but when I fly in, and from Midway or O'Hare, I just enjoy seeing the above ground pools.
Yeah, you're a big above ground pool guy. Yeah.
Parks.
With the decks
Park
that kind schmarks of are, you know, built like halfway around them.
Yeah. Yeah. Love those.
Barbecue on one end.
I like to look and just see whatever's lit up, and I'm like, is that Wrigley Field? Oh, no, it's not. It's just a baseball diamond. Is that Soldier Field? No, that's just a softball diamond in Rolling Meadows. I always feel tricked. I feel duped whenever I come into the airport.